Basically, I'm going to read from the newspaper, and when I'm finished, please feel free to ask any questions. Sinister to establish first last newspaper at Port Authority. Recently described as wheat paste, Dexter Sinister are set to produce a newspaper twice a week for 3 weeks this fall under the umbrella of Performer 09, New York's well-regarded biannual festival of performance art. Together with a hastily assembled staff of international writers and photographers, the Lower East Side pamphleteers will occupy a disused street-level space in New York's Port Authority bus terminal on the corner of 8th Avenue and 41st Street, directly opposite the new New York Times building. According to sources close to Sinister, the first last newspaper will be as much about the current state of news media as anything else. Last night, they hosted a public opening of the workspace from 6 to 8 p.m. and screened Farewell, A Tawin Shridlu, a 1980 documentary narrated by Times linotype operator Carl Schlesinger. Schlesinger offered a brief introduction. The first last newspaper will appear twice a week for the next 3 weeks to be distributed in various formats yet to be announced. Likewise, events open to the public will be arranged during their three-week operation. In Sinister's own characteristically melodramatic words, you don't want to start quantifying things or you're dead. Newspaper tax levied. Few can afford daily sixpence. New York City. Text takes time. It takes time to read, it takes time to write, and it takes time to reproduce. Throughout the history of text production, people have been searching for ways to distribute the costs of producing text, financial, temporal, more evenly across a system. This search led former goldsmith Johannes Gutenberg to develop and refine his system of movable type by the 1450s, which eliminated the laborious book copying process used previously by monastic scribes. And with Gutenberg's system in place, Venetian publisher Aldus Manutius was able to quickly popularize printed books by the late 1400s. As text becomes easier and cheaper to produce, more copies of it get made. While Gutenberg's Bible was printed in small edition of 180, Manutius's books were printed by the thousands. More copies need more readers, and most readers like their text to be portable. While Gutenberg's heavy Bible was best read at a library table, Manutius's slim editions could be easily slipped into saddlebag or vest pocket. You went to Gutenberg's books, but Manutius's books went with you. As increasingly numerous and increasingly portable copies of texts found their way into the world, they found new readers to buy them, and they spread literacy with them. Museum piece, July the 1st, 1978, may have been a ho-hum news day at the New York Times. Fighting in Lebanon, a Manhattan explosion, plans for the upcoming 4th of July. But in the paper's composing room, things were far from routine. On that summer Saturday evening, the next day's early editions of the Times were being printed for the last time from hot type cast from molten lead. Before the night was through, the changeover to cold type set by electronic computer was final and complete. The process began with Gutenberg, the narrator reminds us. Indeed, the machines at work, soon to be auctioned and cannibalized for parts, are of a kind that has, for the past 100 years, remained virtually unchanged. And on this night, when the linotype operator discards the last lead line at the end of the last story and gives his old machine a final pat, when he turns out the lights and closes the door on the suddenly silent room, an era comes to a close. All of the knowledge acquired by the operator in a lifetime of work is now locked in a computer. From now, though, in its state of technical obsolescence, the genius of the linotype concept is no less astonishing than that of its automated successor. And to witness the end of one revolution and the beginning of the next is to be struck anew by the awesome reach of human inventiveness in our urge to communicate. Something funny I have noticed, perhaps you've noticed it too. You know what futurists and onlineists and cut out the middlemanists and Davosists and deconstructionists of every stripe want for themselves? They want exactly what they tell you you no longer need, you pathetic, overweight, disembodied Kindle reader. They want white linen tablecloths on trestle tables in the middle of vineyards on soft, blowy afternoons. You can click on your bottle of wine online, cheaper. They want to go shopping on Saturday afternoons on the Avenue Victor Hugo. They want their pages of their New York Times all kind of greasy from croissant crumbs and butter at a cafe table in Aspen. They want to see their names in hard copy in the new establishment issue of Vanity Fair. They want a 19th century bookshop. They want to see the plays in London. They want to float down the Nile in a felucca. They want a 5-star brick and mortar and do not disturb signs and views of the park. And in order to reserve these things for themselves, they will plug up your eyes and your ears and your mouth. And if they can figure out a way to pump episodes of The Simpsons through the darkening corridors of your brain as you expire, they will do it. Picture an image of a photograph. Picture a man caught in a dispute between drug gangs in Mexico. This image appeared in Time magazine, August 28, 2008. He is lying dead in the street, surrounded by a group of onlookers. Bystanders are taking photos of the body with video digital phone cameras. The number of people in the picture taking a photo of the body almost outnumber those who are not. To understand the economy of this image requires knowing that a piece of information, a photograph, is a unit of exchange in which our attention and the attention of others is accorded value. We don't know the fate of these pictures, but some likely have been posted on the internet to become tokens of exchange on blogs, online communities, and chat lines. We're all involved in an information economy each time we log on to MySpace, send an email, of wherever the circulation of information heightens our visibility. The image economy is founded on our activity as self-performing subjects, feeding back and exchanging information in order to improve our stake within this media feedback loop, the social studio. The term cybernetics, the study of feedback systems, was coined by Norbert Wiener, author of Cybernetics or Control and Communication in the Animal and Machine. Just prior to the United States' entry into World War II, Wiener worked on the development of the anti-aircraft predictor, from which he developed a notion that feedback systems are the organizing system for the universe itself. Circulation, +2.7%, -0.2%. Mid-Atlantic. My 5-foot, 7.5 inches, 126-pound frame is being carried at 566 miles per hour at an altitude of 45,000 feet in a 231-foot-long Boeing 747 flying from London to New York. I am buckled into a 45-centimeter-wide international economy-class seat watching a movie on the 13 by 20 centimeter seatback in-flight entertainment screen in front of me. The movie is called State of Play, a thriller starring Ben Affleck, Russell Crowe, and Rachel McAdams. The plot, old-school Washington Globe journalist and new-school Washington Globe blogger investigate links between squeaky clean congressmen and dirty corporate murder. Old print newshound is skeptical of young blogger's skills as journalist, but together they crack story. I reach the closing scene in which Crowe is typing up his copy, blowing the lid on the whole affair. He finishes his final sentence and, in a symbolic gesture of newfound respect for his blogging sidekick, puts her name next to his in the byline and asks her to hit the enter button on the keyboard that will send their piece to print. The credits roll over a slow, elegantly shot sequence following the subsequent journey of this front page above the fold story. The plates being made, rollers inked up, paper taken from the stack and fed into the press, the news printed, the day's edition being cut, folded, bundled, and shipped out across the country. It's mid-April 2008. My 5-foot, 7.5 inches, 126-pound frame is being carried at 23 knots at an altitude of approximately 20 feet on the Ital Contessa, a 196-foot-long container ship en route from Hamburg to Shanghai. I've been at sea for nearly 5 weeks, and I have never seen so many ships before. Containers, coasters, ro-ros, reefers, bulk carriers, tankers of all sizes. The seas are as busy as motorways. Those heading east are high in the water, their containers empty. Those sailing west to Europe are sunk low in the sea, their cargo heavy with products from China, South Korea, and Taiwan. I begin to think about the passionate futurist sentimentality of online news and ebook advocates. They have their own romance of reportage, that of a brave new first date with technology. Their romance is with a putative democracy of global IT accessibility, allowing a world of citizen journalists to speak truth to power, of Twitter feeds and smartphones bypassing transnational boundaries, bringing instant news of election protests in Iran or police brutality at anti-G20 rallies in London, of a new form of journalist, as adept at constructing reports with the written word as they are with the latest digital AV gear, of direct interaction with readers shaping stories or a title's news agenda, of lower overheads and full-spectrum syndication, of not only news but whole books downloaded to a single e-reader device. It's as if all those science fiction tales about instantaneous global communication have come true when the sleeper wakes, a networked world, men like gods, Wi-Fi, things to come and Star Trek, mobile communications, Earth, citizen journalism, Minority Report, e-newspapers. The newspaper autobritcherists lament rather than capitalize on their own physicality. The online partisans run scared from theirs. Simon, Downey, and Shudson make worthy points, and all of them go on to make the case for innovative economic models that will sustain news gathering. But this still begs a much more basic question: why do we read newspapers? What if the reader's primary concern isn't actually news? A detour. The Guardian's TV critic Nancy Banks Smith reviews a documentary on an aging British bullfighter, Frank, 66, with a quadruple heart bypass and a titanium knee, as well as the BBC's history drama The Tudors. The bullring in Andalusia was like a fading variety theatre. Frank was on first, which suggested he was the juggler, not the crooner. The young bull was slim-legged and deep-bodied. Frank, sporty all his life, has the rangy build of a cowboy. After the first few flourishing passes, the bull, wearing a bleeding necklace of banderillas, stood four square and thought. Frank raised his sword and stopped being funny. When I looked back, the bull had sunk down as if dreadfully tired. This seemed to satisfy the crowd, who waved anything white. Frank gave a bristling press conference. As long as I want to do it, leave me alone and let me get on with it. Perhaps the questions had not been to his taste. A new series of The Tudors was 3 times as long and 10 times as tedious. Henry now has a good queen and a bad leg, which make him very testy, but luckily his girlfriend is sympathetic. Poor you, Your Majesty. It is a more complex transaction between writer and reader than it first appears. The review stands on its own, and it doesn't matter whether or not we've seen the programmes Banks Smith is analysing, an implicit indictment of TV itself. The strength of the piece lies in the play of language and in the assumed communal knowledge of television's formulas. The writer's skill allows her to layer the review with elements of critique, observation, self-reflection, sympathy, and wit. The reader responds on many levels to this particular piece, and, within the context of The Guardian, on a more general level of anticipation and familiarity with this writer's frequent columns. Large Hadron Collider expected to fail due to backwards causation. Geneva. If you've ever stood too close to the edge of a subway platform and deliberately turned to face the oncoming train as it hurtles into the station, then you understand the visceral thrill elicited by the prospect of mortal collision. You also grasp the basic idea behind the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, located approximately 100 metres under the Franco-Swiss border near Geneva, Switzerland. In a ring-shaped tunnel 27 kilometres in circumference, scientists plan to accelerate atomic particles to velocities approaching the speed of light, then force them into head-on collisions. Like you, particle physicists are interested in finding out what happens when things are smashed together at the high speed inside of a tube. In scientific parlance, this is called an event. Unlike you, most of the physicists involved in the LHC project are not dissuaded from experimentation by the possibility of mortal consequence, which is generally considered relatively slight compared, for example, with the chance of death from high-speed convergence with a train. Two well-respected physicists have put forth a theory in recent months that the failure of the LHC is inevitable precisely because the universe cannot survive its success. Is such cosmic alarm warranted? Time will tell, and very soon. Last weekend, the first beam of lead ions was injected into the LHC since its failure and temporary closure over a year ago. According to the website of the European Organization for Nuclear Research, which built the LHC, the first proton beam of the year is likely to be injected in mid-November. The first high-energy collisions will most likely occur at a date after mid-December 2009. If the predictions of Nielsen and Ninomiya are correct, then we almost certainly have nothing to worry about. Two men describe bloody good elephant. A few days beforehand, one of the first last newspaper's regular correspondents pitched the idea of an interview with renowned sound engineer and polymath Walter Murch, making a case for his inclusion with reference to the following quotation. At the basic level, a transition is simply the process of changing from some state A to another state B. What we should examine carefully is the degree of change and our awareness of it. Change is happening all the time, though we are not always conscious of it, but without change there is no perception. This is somewhat of a paradox. If you're staring constantly at a static object, you would think that nothing is changing, but it turns out your eyeballs are constantly moving. Though the movements are so tiny, you're unaware of it. You might be stationary, the object you're staring at might be stationary, but your eyeballs are rapidly scanning the image in what are called microsaccades, at the rate of around 60 per second. It is this slight vibration, the eyeballs are moving at about 1/180th of a degree, that is keeping your perception alive, scrubbing the image across a slightly different set of rods and cones at the back of your eye. In a way, it is kind of like the scanning electron gun in a video monitor. Fascinating experiments have been performed neutralizing these microsaccades, and the result is that the vision of the subject quickly dims and then disappears entirely, even though his eyes are open and he is in a lighted room. At a very basic perceptual level, then, there has to be some kind of transition, a change for us to perceive the world at all. This statement describes both the point and point of view of the first last newspaper with such alarming economy that we urged our correspondent to follow the lead. As it turned out, she wasn't scheduled to meet Murch, only invited to a dinner he would also attend. If I could ask Murch only one question, she wondered, what would that be? One designed to extract an exact replica of that quotation, we replied. The after-dinner conversation reportedly lasted 4 hours. Blind man in dark room looking for black cat that's not there. 50 years before conceptualism, Duchamp disrupted the territory of art at its core by asking, can one make a work of art that is not of art? Can there be an art that isn't? How can one invent an entirely other way of thinking and knowing? Can one imagine a new epistemological map equipped with an additional dimension that reaches outside and beyond the familiar north-south poles of knowing and not knowing? The contemporary cultural theorist Sara Maharaj has named this other epistemological dimension in his discussion of xeno-epistemic and the proposal of avidya. In the provocative spirit of the work of art that isn't, why not adopt the term non-knowledge, despite pejorative connotations, for visual art's cognitive processes? Non-knowledge, at any rate, is not at all the same as ignorance. It refers to the knowledge system's other, that indeterminate xenozone between knowledge and ignorance. For this infra-thin chink, let's use the term avidya. In Sanskrit, vidya means knowledge, as in the phrase to see, know. The Latin cognate is video, to see, and its modern English cousin is video. The prefix a signals the neutral gear, a semi-freeze. The idea that systematic knowledge is neutralized in avidya, but not entirely annulled. Vidya and avidya are not quite binaries. As Duchamp explored, a Maharaj recognizes art can operate outside the linear or binary axis of ignorance slash knowledge and introduce another epistemological dimension, non-knowledge, avidya, or productive confusion, that itself represents a powerful form of knowledge, a way of knowing. Duchamp's way into this other dimension was by way of what he called the infra-thin. This is the place of Poincaré's fourth dimension, Gödel's undecidability, Maharaja's avidya, art that isn't, and a work of art that is not of art. They came to see who came. For those of us raised with the notion that the press and TV news exist to somehow get to the bottom of things, and that the news media is a forum in which these things can be proven or disproved, the ease with which transparent nonsense became a matter of fact that could justify fatal action came as a shock. Whether this thing we call the news media is not in its nature to simply test matters of fact. The weapons of mass destruction incident demonstrated that the apparatus of media actually has the ability to produce facts. The press briefing demonstrates two fundamental things about the structure of contemporary media. It is a feedback loop that gives legitimacy and conveys narrative to its producers, and the mediation that produced weapons of mass destruction reminds us of French philosopher Michel Foucault's most valuable lesson. Discourse produces its object. In 1962, Daniel Burstein coined the term pseudo-event to describe events designed solely to be reported, presidential debates, press conferences, and media burns. But Andy Warhol understood better than anyone else that the media event isn't something you simply consume. Describing the unfolding hallucination of the factory, Warhol said, "They came to see who came. The people who come to see the party become the party. The figure and ground become a single flowing image. In the same way, the figure and ground of the press shifts backwards and forwards from the press as they arrive to report the event and to the press as their bodies provide the props for the event." In the next installment of this series, we will look at why we, as performers in the media feedback loop, are losing the script and picking up the format. Icons govern action. Peter Fend is tall and thin, apparently averse to palaver. Conversations with him begin as if they might be ended at any moment by forces beyond immediate control. Until then, there is a great deal of ground to be covered and not enough time to cover it. To a meeting, during his recent trip to New York, he brought an oversized suitcase full of drawings and papers, from which he procured plans and documentation from Ocean Earth as he spoke. Files were opened, Xeroxes were made, photographs were taken. The air in the room was bated. In Fenn's company, one has the palpable sense that the clock is ticking on civilization. Fenn expresses frustration with the economic disempowerment of artists. I have long argued that the art world is corrupt. It is not transparent and not financially or legally honest. The power structure wants art to be disempowered. It does not want the changes that result from new thought, i.e. art. As a result, the artwork has engendered a religion of disbelief. Whatever is shown or is said is supposed to be disbelieved. It is supposed to be not real. It is supposed to not work. Gonzo pragmatism. There's been a lot of talk about pragmatism recently, but the rearticulation of its wit is a tricky proposition. Divested of its philosophical humor, pragmatism is reduced to an ideological travesty when it appears in its current dominant form, the imposed pressure to improvise under all circumstances to the best of your abilities. The relation between the originary philosophy and its ideological version is an ongoing struggle carried out in the arena of everyday culture, politics, and ethics. As such, it seems important to highlight instances of people who perform the adversary ethos of pragmatism in their work and wit. To write the history of this antagonism is to support those who have taken sides with the philosophy and against the ideology. This insistence is inherently anti-economical. In a scenario of all-out economic pressure, ruled by deadlines, time spent considering the preliminaries of how to engage will always seem like wasted time, or at least time that no one can afford. To take that time, indeed, to even show that it exists in a culture governed by the economic imperative, makes good manners the closest you might get to civil disobedience. The danger of embracing good manners, however, is its tacit espousal of conservatism. It certainly doesn't sound like disobedience. It seems crucial again, therefore, to switch tracks and re-emphasize the irreverent wit at the heart of pragmatic philosophy, and to note that the ability to maintain a constant awareness and balance of the two, the good-mannered and the irrelevant, seems to be what we're after here. The pits. What will it look like is a question of the hour, as people try to visualize the ways in which life will change in New York as a result of the financial and economic crisis. In the mind's eye, we tend to populate our recessionary streets with squad cars painted green, cat's eyes ambulances, and other anachronisms. Fort Apache, the Bronx, the remake. But really, the city will probably just look like the way it does now. After an extraordinary era of construction and renovation, demolition and replacement, there will almost certainly come a long period in which little to nothing gets built. Putting aside the long-discussed public projects that are endangered or doomed, the Second Avenue subway, the West Side rail yards, Brooklyn Bridge Park, Moynihan Station, etc., dozens of private undertakings have stalled or died. The calls go out to the architects, pencils down. We have inherited from the good years a glut of housing, almost all of it of the unaffordable kind, condos galore, and an increase in office space amid a sudden steep decrease in the need for it. Throw in the high cost or total unavailability of capital owing to the credit freeze, and you have a New York that may be frozen in time. The skyline, which has been very dynamic recently, like a stereo's equalizer display, should sit still for a while. The clothes in our closets today will be the ones we're wearing when we're old. Fifth wall, a fifth estate collapses. An everyday euphemism for the press, itself a widely used yet increasingly semantically outdated title that refers to news media in general and journalism in particular, the Fourth Estate was originally coined as a supplement to clergy, nobility, and commoners, respectively the First, Second, and Third Estates, in certain parts of middle-aged Europe, and generally considered to be more important than all three. Not to be confused with the Fourth Wall, an imaginary plane between actors and audience in such as a theatre or soap opera that has since come to refer more broadly to the gap between fiction and reality, often breached by art forms that adopt an authorial distance in which this wall or suspension of disbelief is broken by the work's reference to its own artifice in order to alienate or estrange an audience and foster a more critical perception. Not to be confused with the Fifth Estate, a floating term that refers to certain social groups outside the four traditional pillars, such as trade unions, organized crime, or more recently, the blogosphere, and similar realms that consider themselves counter to the mainstream media. And not to be confused with the Fifth Wall, a second removed boundary of reality separation applied to a performance where a character within one fictional world refers to a previous character played by the same, typically typecast actor in a totally unrelated fictional world. New legislation combats chicken-egg problem. London. British literary historian N.N. Feltes has said that readers are made by what makes the book, meaning the system that produces a text also produces the readers who read it. In Charles Dickens's case, that system was serial publication. But in Dickens's case, that system was also the nascent Industrial Revolution, which involved a ship from what Feltes described as the petty commodity production of books, with books produced in small quantities by artisans, to the capitalist production of texts, where books were produced in mass quantities by professional printers and publishers. In a very short time, The book production system went from something like that which produced a homespun quilt to something like that which produced bolts of industrially woven fabric. While the machines made the fabric cheaper and easier to make, its weavers owed nothing but their labor in making it. And while presses made books cheaper and easier to make, their authors in turn owed nothing but their power to conceive them. The comparison of writing to weaving is not lost on Feltes, who uses it to recall Marx. While the condition of early 19th century writers could never decline to that of their wretched contemporaries, the handloom weavers, nevertheless, Marx's comment on the weaver's predicament in the face of the new reactions of industrial production is illuminating. Marx noticed that workers in a capitalist system are estranged from the work they make. Since their work is no longer their own, the concept of labour arrives to take its place. And this yields, as Marx says, the conditions of labour and the product of labour. The book, which was once the work, is now the product. Its text, which was also once the book, is now the labour. Its author's right is not the product, not to the product, but to his or her individual labour. In one stroke, the professional author and the commodity text were born, along with the mass-consuming public to support them. Classic pyramid inverted. Ungirding any news item in any medium is a skeleton of facts. The visible outside might be a glassy feature treatment, a cantilevered opinion piece, or, bringing the bizarre to this metaphor, the classic inverted pyramid. This term refers to the age-old hard news presentation that perches the weightiest details at the top of the story with increasingly less important details in the subsequent paragraphs. The facts are the basis of the story, and through judicious combination of accumulated facts, the reporter adds dimension to a story. As journalists are laid off, the gap between the public record and all reportable facts grows. Fewer people collecting facts means fewer facts collected, the dimension of the public record expanding more slowly. As it approaches infinity, layoffs mean the inevitable permanent loss of dimension, stopping the film, slicing off all but the painting's edge, or squashing the sculpture flat. The semantic discipline. One of the most attractive parts of the semantic discipline is the deflation of all words and all statements, the meaning of which cannot be established by reference to operations and events in the world of tangible things. Thus, all high-order abstractions and words which are mere emotional noises are to be replaced by semantic blanks or the word blab. About half the present vocabulary of politicians, clerics, philosophers, economists, and others afflicted with proselytizing zeal will thus be swept away as so much meaningless noise. Absolutes will be removed from our language as they have been removed from the physicist's conception of the universe by the theory of relativity. And all such terms as God, democracy, the proletariat, truth, justice, the logos, communism, the just price, fascism, collective security and the like, terms as to the meaning of which there is and can be no possibility of common agreement amongst mankind, and which are therefore useless for purposes of communication, these will be all uniformly replaced by the word blab, and nothing else will become audible until someone begins to talk about particular men and women, or an identifiable group of men and women, and their bread and onions. To borrow an example from Mr. Chase, the Aryan fatherland, which has nursed the souls of heroes, calls upon you for the supreme sacrifice which you, in whom flows heroic blood, will not fail, and which will forever echo down the corridors of history, would be translated. The blab blab, which has nursed the blabs of blabs, calls upon you for the blab blab which you, in whom flows blab blood, will not fail, and which will blab echo down the blabs of blab. If, however, a political leader says, every adult in the geographical area called Germany will receive not more than 2 loaves of bread per week for the next 6 months, there is little possibility of communication failure. There is not a blab in a carload of such talk. Engineer and tinkerer caught in bricolage. Structural anthropologist and New Yorkophile French writer Claude Levi-Strauss died 2 weeks ago, 1 month short of his 101st birthday. As Larry Roter in last Sunday's New York Times concisely describes, Levi-Strauss's writings thrive on binary oppositions. Hot and cold, raw and cooked, animal and human. And it is through these opposing binary concepts, he said, that humanity makes sense of the world. In the short piece, Roter usefully translates the French term bricoleur as the tinkerer and opposes it to the engineer. In chapter 1 of The Savage Mind, Levi-Strauss describes the bricoleur. Consider him at work and excited by his project. His first practical step is retrospective. He has to turn back to an already existent set made up of tools and materials to consider or reconsider what it contains, and finally, and above all, to engage in a sort of dialogue with it and, choosing between them, to index the possible answers which the whole set can offer to his problem. He interrogates all the heterogeneous objects of which his treasury is composed to discover what each of them could signify and so contribute to the definition of a set which is yet to materialize, but which will ultimately differ from the instrumental set only in the internal disposition of its parts. Puissant God reviewed, man after all. Dickens visited America again in 1867 to 1868 at the end of his life. Though seriously ill, he complained of catching a true American catarrh. He nevertheless managed to solicit the support of writers Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and gave 22 readings at New York's Steinway Hall through the dead of winter. In the audience, one cold January night, was a 33-year-old journalist and budding author named Mark Twain, who'd worked as a printer in New York, Philadelphia, St. Louis, and Cincinnati while educating himself at public libraries in the evenings. After making a comfortable living as a steamboat captain, Twain had found his way westward and reviewed Dickens' reading for the San Francisco newspaper Alta California, writing of his idol, "Somehow this puissant god seemed to be only a man after all. How the great do tumble from their high pedestals when we can see them in common human flesh and know that they eat pork and cabbage and act like other men. Where does your money come from? As an artist, I am often asked, where does your money come from? The question comes in two variations. The first is largely innocent and occurs whenever my relatives or members of the non-art public, having in my presence come across an artwork I have made, generally wonder how it can be possible to get paid for having made it. When I explain that there are many people who like to look at artworks and compare them to other ones over time, and a few in that group are even willing to pay extraordinary amounts of money, relative to materials and labour, for what they feel are the more interesting examples, my non-art friends squint their eyes a little and cock their heads at me, as if something nefarious was going on. When I resort, by way of example, to the goings-on at craft fairs or the Antiques Roadshow, they brighten because they know someone who earns a living making handbags, or whose Star Wars paraphernalia was appraised at $50,000. After they tell me about somebody who has been similarly fortunate, I nod and say, yeah, art's just like that. And unfailingly, their heads straighten and their squints dissolve. They still know nothing about art, but at least they've understood how it works. And how something works is always a more nagging question than what something means. The second variant of the question about my money is usually posed by graduate students or architects, and is much more angry and troubling. It's intended to undermine my authority as an invited speaker, or to expose a conceit I clearly have, a brickbat hurled from behind the stanchions of real-life drudgery that is the domain of architects and graduate students. That doesn't bother me. My veins are already coursing with the homeopathic toxins of commerce, so I'm immune to such naive humiliations. What does bother me about total strangers being concerned with my money, though, is the presumption that making a living is not an acceptable motivation for an artist. To me, for better or worse, all art is nothing if not a proposal for how the current situation might be altered at a profit. That profit is not immediately apparent to us is nothing against an artwork or its maker, and I, for one, refuse to live in a society where skilled individuals cannot earn a living however they please. If my best chance at making a living entails drawing snowflakes with a compass and gouache, then I can only hope that a liberal capitalist democracy such as ours will afford a niche in which to ply my trade. Otherwise, the philosophical pillars of our society would be revealed to be not as liberal or democratic as they seem. For this reason, nothing is more impressive or politically reaffirming than an artist who is gainfully self-employed. You are not a very nice girl. The values of self-reliance and independence, along with the techniques of self-management, are central to the structure of the non-scripted TV show. In the non-scripted TV show, the subject is repeatedly placed in the judgment of their peers, or instructed by someone with greater experience, or guided by a mentor, or counseled by counselors. Parents display their errant children before experts who measure their delinquency and give feedback. The family, after undergoing the examination of the audience, takes up the challenge of a regime of self-improvement. An overweight actress, whose weight has fluctuated over the years, confesses her lack of self-discipline on a talk show. She renews her promise to lose weight and invites a film crew to chart her progress. It is in the arena of the non-scripted TV show that the mechanisms of self-management are played out. It is here that things are measured, tested, evaluated, examined, recorded, and judged, ticking all the boxes you need to make a surveillance system. This is the way we govern ourselves, and this is the way we are governed. Not by following orders or meeting obligations, but by taking up challenges and exercising choices. May need rewrite. In theory, the idea that anyone with internet access can voice their opinion in reaction to a published text and bounce their ideas off other readers in healthy debate is a good one. And in many cases, new communities of readers and writers and thinkers have grown around certain blogs, which have generated large amounts of interesting material that might not otherwise get published elsewhere. However, there has been a broader effect of this access and excess of opinion. On writing both personal blogs and pieces for online publication, an effect more psychological than many initially supposed. Types of comment range from pleasant thanks to the writer through courteously added further points of interest into spirited debate, and all the way to pedantic unpicking of holes in an argument, bellicose riposts and flat-out abuse. Little by little, and in fear of intellectual stripes being torn off them by their commentators, writers have started to feel obliged to nuance their text until their rhetorical spirit is completely ironed out, or their argument has become a convoluted mess of caveats, digressions, and subclauses. Writer Mark Fisher, on his K-Punk blog, has recently started compiling a bestiary of the main types of respondent found in comment threads. There is the troll, for instance, who revels in nitpicking critique and wears with pride an inability to commit to any position. They see this posture of alleged detachment, this sneer from nowhere, as a virtue, a sign of their maturity. Then there is the grey vampire, who on the outside is friendly and sociable, but on the inside, like the troll, cannot commit themselves to anything. Both are subordinated to the fear and its demand that we be irreverent, that we constitute ourselves as ironically self-deflating subjects. I'm the sort of person who... Fisher contrasts this with the enthusiastic fan writer, often the victim of the troll or grey vampire, because it's always other people who are fans. Our own attachments, we like to pretend, have been arrived at by a properly judicious process and are not at all excessive. His point about irreverence is key. The dominant pose at the present moment is that of the everyman, a common sense approach that allows for no flights of fancy or evidence of rarefied intellectual or aesthetic tastes. Any demonstration of interest in complex ideas or cultural esoterica is acceptable only when couched in "I'm just an ordinary guy" terms, lest the trolls jump on you for pretentiousness or the vampires slowly suck from your soul any enthusiasm you had to share your ideas with anyone. Whether trolls, grey vampires, or fans, the domain of blog commentators is collectively coalescing into a picture of sorts. It is that of a nebulous but nonetheless highly reactive popular front, a digital chorus of anonymously signed or pseudonymic opinion that exerts a kind of peer pressure on those who publish online. It may be a chimera, but it's an intimidating one. Filmmaker Adam Curtis identified its curious power when he described bloggers as the new censors. Writers now second-guess responses. They self-police themselves for fear that their biases, elisions, or inclusions will be shot down in flames by the inevitable Inquisition. Writing becomes an act done while looking over your shoulder. Some die, some get hurt, some go on. Joyce Carol Oates makes an interesting comment on style and language in an observation on Mike Tyson in 1986. "I want to punch the bone into the brain." Tyson's language is as direct and brutal as his ring style, yet as more than one observer has noted, strangely disarming. There is no air of menace or sadism or boastfulness in what he says, only the truth. Why this affinity of writers and fighters, where one has a promoter, the other has a publisher, one has a manager, the other has an agent, one has a trainer, the other has an editor? But when the bell rings, it's sort of interchangeable. You're out there under the bright lights feeling naked and alone. And what you do or fail to do out there can make or break your reputation in life. Socrates, guard up, pants down. New York. Around here, we like to do things properly. Haphazard work and half-baked ideas won't cut it. Really, if you don't care, why should we? Uncaring, unfeeling, unthinking people tend to have little more to share than their own inappropriate sense of self-importance, and we've seen enough of that. Let's do things differently from now on. Let's do them properly. What the hell does proper mean, anyway? Greek philosophy has an answer. What is proper to someone or something is what fits their characteristic properties. For example, it is proper for fish to be in water. It suits them. What equivalent state would be proper to writing? To appear in print or to writers? To be in a state of grace or in perpetual crisis? What if both print media and writers were in crisis? Were they ever not? Greek philosophy also states that criticism is derived from crisis. The critique in Greek jurisprudence and medicine was understood as a votum passed on an undecided situation that determined the point of crisis at which it would decide itself, the climax of a jurisdictional dispute or the turning point of an illness. The proper place for the critique to determine the crisis was the criterion, the court of law or site of medical inspection. In its original sense, then, crisis is to criticism what water is to fish. It is its proper medium. The proper task of critical writing and publishing is to navigate situations in which preconceived ideas of what is proper no longer seem appropriate. When it wiggles like a fish through an eddy of crisis, a critical voice or a critical medium comes into their own. Philosophically speaking, then, the inappropriate is the only form proper to critical writing and publishing. From The Economist, August the 24th, 2006. In his book, The Vanishing Newspaper, Philip Mayer calculates that the first quarter of 2043 will be the moment when newsprint dies in America as the last exhausted reader tosses aside the last crumpled edition. Mass inoculation against bacteria of doubt. In late 1977, New York's favorite gonzo rock journalist Lester Bangs wrote a three-part serialized account of touring with English punk new wave band The Clash for the British weekly New Musical Express. The assignment found Bangs in a funk, saying, "Things started going downhill for rock about 1968, culminating in the ascendance of things like disco and jazz rock, which are dead enough to suggest the end of popular music as we know it, to the point of thinking about giving up writing about music altogether." But Bangs was pried out of resignation by a sudden demand for coverage of the UK punk scene, which within 1 year of its initial explosion was merely repeating the very attitudes it copped: boredom and indifference, a sorry state which amounted to capitulation rather than construction. Instead, Bangs was on the trail of a persistent humanism, in spite of the fact that one of the most uncool things you can do these days is be committed to anything. Joining the tour jet-lagged and combative, with a friend's advice to ask them just what their political program is, what they intend to do once past all the bullshit rhetoric. Lester begins his relationship with the band by unleashing a battery of questions along the lines of blah, 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 depersonalization, blah, 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 solipsism, blah, blah, yip, yap, blah, blah, no one wants to have emotions anymore, blah, blip, human heart and endangered species, blah, blah, cultural fascism, blah, blurt, etc., 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 which is immediately met with laughter, then disarmed by the offhand response, if it bothers you so much, why don't you do something about it? In a telling incident, one of the band asks Lester, "My room is full tonight. Can Adrian stay with you?" gesturing at one of the fans. Bangs is outraged, makes a scene, then discovers to his considerable amazement that indeed the band regularly houses acquaintances and fans on tour, at which point he is forced to consider the degree to which his own attitude is shaped by his standard experience of large-scale US bands tours, i.e. involving goddamn pigs who have the usual burly cops of hired thugs to help keep the fans away from them at all costs. By contrast, the way the Clash treat their fans falls so far outside the normal run of things as to be outright revolutionary. From here on, Bangs realizes why it wasn't necessary to do any boring interviews about politics or the class system or any of that, because here is a band which not only preaches something good, but preaches it, but practices it as well. The way the band interact with their audience, instead of talking about changes in social behavior, puts the model of a truly egalitarian practice in their own conduct. Even better is the band's response to his telling them as much, "Oh, so that's going to be the hook for your story then," which it is, along with the unanswered question he lets hang. How long the group can continue to practice total egalitarianism in the face of mushrooming popularity. Well aware of his proclivity to rant, generalize, polemicize, Bang concludes anyway, saying, "You may say I take liberties, and you are right, but I will have done my good deed for the day if I can make you see that the whole point is you should be taking liberties too. Nothing is so inscribed, so deep, that a little eyewash won't uproot it. That's the whole point of the so-called new wave, to reinvent yourself and everything around you constantly." How Marinetti taught me to write. Maybe, just maybe, all the rat-sat-sang boom-fi-sci stuff is a distraction. Maybe even Marinetti got distracted, and in acting out his own instructions, missed the most incisive part of them. If I'm right, and I may well not be, then the great futurist novel is certainly not Mafarka the Futurist, nor is it Crash. The great futurist novel is Ulysses, the epic whose true heroes are vibrating tramlines, jingling bedposts and a bar of soap, whose cosmic vision is of spinning gas balls and frozen rock, of existences concealed in cavities of the earth beneath removable stones, in hives and mounds of microbes, germs, bacteria, bacilli, spermatozoa, whose episodes, like Marinetti's car crash or Quixote's night, are permeated by the smell of excreta. Perhaps it's no coincidence that the bulk of Ulysses was written in Trieste, the city Marinetti called our beautiful powder keg, nor perhaps that its inciting incident involving a gun being discharged over Joyce's head in a Martello tower, a bunker for the military surveillance of space's vectors and approach lines, whose middle floor consisted of a gunpowder magazine and on whose roof a cannon sat, a gun inside a gun. Has Marinetti's demand been attended to in recent years? I'd say so, kind of. In a range of media, in the prosthetic imagination of David Lynch, or the vanguard bombast of Einstürzende Neubauten, for example, but in contemporary writing, much less. To the question of what a genuinely Marinettian current writing might look like, I can only answer litotically, in other words, by defining it as the negative of its opposite. What is not is what dominates current literary fiction, a humanist, psychological writing in which everything proceeds from a self that's never put in question, in which man is unbreached and unmultiplied, a writing that serves as a vanity mirror for liberal culture to reflect itself back to itself in the way that it wants to see itself. Any editor at any major publishing house will tell you that they're largely expected to take their bearings from and shape their editorial policy around the feedback that they get from reading groups whose members want nice, rounded characters that they can imagine sharing thoughts over a glass of Chardonnay. Well, fuck that. Literature begins where identity and knowledge are ruptured, multiplied, transmitted along chains of language and the vectors of the world, passing through switch points that flip them over into something else. The Greeks knew this. Look at Clymenestra's beacon telegraph speech in the first act of Agamemnon, or Cassandra's strange linguistic jump cuts in the same play, or the vast switchboardery of oracles and signs that govern Oedipus's transit through both space and time, a play which also, incidentally, revolves around a violent highway incident. We've always known this, but it needs restating sometimes, and Marinetti's manifestos are the most lucid modern statement I can think of. Spider-Man in World Wide Web. Whether I take my news over breakfast or over the wireless connection, I still, somewhere in the back of my mind, believe in the superhero reporter. It's no coincidence that Superman and Spider-Man both work for the press. Clark Kent is its witness, the reporter, and Peter Parker, its forensic department, the photographer. Both work for truth and justice, both in order to protect the secret identities Clark sometimes has to bear false witness and fake stories, and Peter has to tamper with the evidence and fake pictures. I'm still waiting for the first blogging superhero, but when he or she does appear, what media myths will they carry over to the blogosphere? The bastards are making it up. 10 years earlier, a youthful Tom Wolfe had looked out across the city room of the Herald Tribune for the first time and experienced an immediate revulsion. The place looked like the receiving bin of the Goodwill, a promiscuous heap of junk, wreckage and exhaustion everywhere. All the intestines of the building were left showing in diverticulitic loops and lines, electrical conduits, water pipes, steam pipes, effluvium ducts, sprinkler systems, all of it dangling and grunting from the ceiling, the walls, the columns. The whole mess from top to bottom was painted over in industrial sludge, lead grey, subway green, or that unbelievable dead red, that grim distemper of pigment and filth that they paint on the floor within the tool and dye works. On the ceiling were scalding banks of fluorescent lights, turning the atmosphere radiant blue and burning bald spots into the crowns of the copy readers who never moved. It turns out that these restless feature writers, sensing their freedom, were never making it up. They were tearing it all down. Burn. Itself feels like the last of something. But what of Milevich's zero point and its proposed transcendence? With the climate in post-revolutionary Russia progressing into Stalinism, the proposition of materialist abstraction had become a symbol of bourgeois elitism. Milevich returned to his pre-suprematist foundations, producing canvases that aped his antecedents, first Cubo-futurism and at its most extreme, Impressionism. Stranger still, Milevich backdated these works so that his suprematist works remained the foregone conclusion of these styles, turning his own progression into an ellipse, doubling back on itself. He was trapped in his own origin story. Since he held to the conviction that he had reached the end point of painting, the height of purism in form, there was nowhere to go but backward. My own zero point would come at L.A. Prime, the steakhouse on the top floor of the hotel. There, a surprise party awaited me, a crown on the birthday excursion. And I realized I'd gone for days without having a face-to-face conversation lasting more than a minute. Prior temporal logic, tired. Take the statement, I am tired, for example. While its meaning does not change, it is sometimes true and sometimes less so. And a person acts differently depending on the extent of tiredness, going to bed versus going on a hike. This example of temporal logic is borrowed from last Sunday's New York Times obituary of computer scientist and philosopher Amir Pnuli. Temporal logic is a formal system of logical reasoning used to evaluate statements whose truth changes over time. Dr. Pnuli did not invent this branch of logic, but he was the first to apply it to the operation of computer systems with his fundamental 1977 paper, The Temporal Logic of Programs. Before Dr. Pnuli, self-taught Oxford professor Alfred Norman Prior rigorously articulated temporal logic and gave the subject its name. Of course, the multipart problem of truth as it varies over time sits at the root of the basic philosophical problems of determinism and free will. However, Prior's temporal logic specifically distills the fundamental concepts of a truth which is negotiated over time into a mathematically rigorous logical language whose formality and abstraction allows it to address an infinitely wide scope of truth claims and to remain specific in its conclusions. Prior built his temporal logic on the work of 19th century philosopher and mathematician Charles Sanders Peirce. Peirce, who also coined the philosophically proper term pragmatism, argued for a logic which makes accommodation for the changing truth of a statement over time. As within the wider scope of pragmatism, Peirce argued that truth must be determined fully contingent on the present situation and that truth is actually produced by this negotiation or back and forth with the world. When he started teaching logic at Canterbury University and publishing his work, Prior knew only modest mathematics and was almost entirely self-taught in logic. He published his first logic paper at the age of 38, a remarkably late debut in mathematics, where the best thinking is said to be all done by age 28. Prior published his seminal book, fully articulating temporal logic, just 2 years before his death, Past, Present, Future, in 1967. The practical value of Prior's temporal logic is being able to speak concretely, precisely, of the past, present, and future all at the same time, at the only time that it is ever possible to actually bring an idea into the world, the continuous present. I am tired. I have been tired. I will be tired. I have always been tired. I will, probably, not always be tired. Then, to bed, for now. Correct me if I'm wrong. Perhaps these six installments of How Media Masters Reality have painted a bleak picture of us as lab rats in our own experiment, or maybe something like a post-mass media Hieronymus Bosch painting in which the damned labour on the eternal work of being watched. But once we gain knowledge of How Media Masters Reality, we might begin to work out ways of finding our freedom within it. French philosopher Michel Foucault was once asked, if we are socially constructed, is conscious change possible? Foucault turned the question on its head. We actually don't realize how free we are. There are more freedoms than the horizon of the humanist tradition can show us, and the one thing we can learn from the development of human thought is that change is inevitable. Zero divided by zero results in zero. Chicago. If you've read newspapers regularly for the past two decades, probably you encountered higher mathematics once, when Andrew Wiles proved Fermat's last theorem in 1994. Maybe you paid enough attention to notice when Poincaré's conjecture was confirmed in 2006. If you haven't encountered anything else on math, it's not your fault. Zero divided by anything is still zero. Why isn't there popular press coverage of mathematics? Because it's too obscure. An unspoken premise here is that the press doesn't cover obscure things. Take as a simple counterexample the New York Times article of October 29 titled, 7.3 billion light years later, Einstein's theory prevails, which included this sentence. Some theorists have suggested that space on very small scales has a granular structure that would speed some light waves faster than others. In short, that relativity could break down on the smallest scales. Because it's too difficult. Difficult things make the paper every day. Healthcare reform, complex political scandals explaining the financial crash, and, as was already mentioned, science. It's the job of the journalist to simplify complicated topics by prioritizing the information she collects and finding clear ways to express it. In journalism, the reader need not understand everything about a topic on a visceral level. Hard news stories are written so that a reader who quits reading in the middle will still have hit the main point. Readers of news first learn the main outline and why it's important, then fill in the broad strokes, then smaller details. There's no a priori reason why math can't be presented in this model, because it's too boring. Boring is in the eye of the benumbed. Scores of readers never open the sports section. Rafts of them never read travel. Masses won't touch religion, because it doesn't talk about the real world. Math's real-world applications are no farther afield than science page darlings like cosmology and string theory. Because it takes too long to explain anything, the article length and in terminology gap exists in writing about other specialized disciplines. When the Large Hadron Collider opened on the Swiss-French border, articles defined the still theoretical Higgs boson as a subatomic particle that would give matter mass. Math terms can be explained too, at least in as much as a casual reader needs to understand them. Because it's too rigorous. Now we're getting somewhere. Math people are probably already sputtering that casual readers won't really get it if simplistic explanations present just the broad strokes of their work. Here's the central conflict. Reality getting it isn't the point of journalism. Math is about rigor. A mathematical statement enters the body of knowledge when it is proved. Journalism is about importance. A story is successful when it imparts the most important pieces of information with the greatest concision. Science doesn't pose this conflict. The minimization of unavoidable error and weighing of the statistical significance of correlation coefficients don't come from the world of 100% certainty. Philosophy suffers as math does. If you can name a philosophy publication other than On Bullshit from the past 20 years, gold star. Because people don't like it. People don't like it because they can't wrap their minds around it. They can't wrap their minds about it because no one presents it accessibly. No one presents it accessibly because people don't like it. That's really the essence of it. But geometers would call that argument circular. Patience, fortitude, remain lions. In the final painting, a freestanding panel affixed to a mahogany and walnut veneered trolley that visitors can move around the library, Laning gazes into the future, or rather, what appears to be our present. Unlike its four siblings, the fifth panel is oriented landscape rather than portrait, partly to allow the painting to be moved easily from room to room. And Laning uses the widescreen format to paint a scene that looks as if it were lifted straight from Fritz Lang's Metropolis or a Le Corbusier drawing. In the center of the image, we see a young man working at a typewriter. By his side are a notebook and camera, items that suggest he is a reporter. From his typewriter extends a cluster of sleek tubes that shoot from his keyboard into the middle distance of the left-hand side of the painting. Above the pipes, ranged across hilltops behind which a rosy-fingered dawn is breaking, are a series of buildings, not too dissimilar in style to the Beaux-Arts NYPL itself. Each carries a different national flag, USA, Britain, France. Radio masts crown these buildings from which, perhaps in homage to RKO's famous logo, concentric circles emanate. In the lower left quadrant of the panel, we see teams of white-coated technicians attending vast banks of machines housed in grand interiors reminiscent of the McGraw Rotunda. To the right of the young writer, in the immediate foreground, is a woman looking into what appears to be a luminous makeup compact, but is engraved on the outside with the words, Daily News. Next to her, a group of school children are seen carrying leather satchels that one or two in the group also appear to be using as exercise books. Behind them, factory workers in a canteen read from a giant screen while they eat. But all is not necessarily well in Laning's future of the recorded world. Older, white-bearded men guard vast stacks of books from a marauding crowd as printing presses are fed into smelting furnaces. The sky behind them has turned from beautiful dawn into an abstract Kandinsky-esque spectrum of color. 20 questions inverted. When I met Murch at a dinner during his visit to New York, the entire table of guests remained rapt for several hours after the plates were cleared, engrossed by a conversation in which Murch stitched filmmaking to astronomy, to studies of human perception, to the congruence of the belief systems of Hopi Indians, ancient Greeks and contemporary physicists. At one point, Murch described the inherently complex, collaborative process of filmmaking as a game of inverse 20 questions, a variation on Exquisite Corpse. In the standard version of 20 questions, a designated guesser leaves the room while the remaining players select an object together. The returning guesser's objective is to identify the chosen object through the course of asking up to 20 questions of the other players. In a game of inverse 20 questions, the players do not concur while the guesser is out of the room. Instead, as the guesser asks each question, all the players continually modify their assumption about what the object might be. Ideally, the entire group of players arrives at an object together without having initially agreed upon a winning answer. Sometimes the game simply falls apart. Corduroy Pillow makes headlines. Whose throat can I eat? The internet didn't do it. Whatever problems exist with news today have their roots much further back in time. If we now have celebrities rather than stars, it's because publicists demand a total control over interviews and features on their artists from the 1980s onwards. Creativity was smothered, the artist's take on reality was elided, and a bland mainstream profile was cultivated for each client. It's not that the flaws of the famous are hidden from us either, simply that those stumbles are now packaged within a neat career trajectory that includes rehab as a saintly rest station on the longer journey. As each artistic career has become more manufactured and predictable, so the status of these figures has declined. It's that energy and total commitment to language and writing that makes a good journalist. If it can be wrapped in the broad folds of a newspaper filled with writing that defies the logic of the bulletin, then even better. But it's that willingness to go for the jugular that induces pleasure. Readers know this instinctively, and they always catch the scent of a kill. Kafkaesque. Alas, said the mouse, the world is growing smaller every day. At the beginning, it was so big that I was afraid. I kept running and running, and I was glad when at last I saw walls far away to the right and left. But these long walls have narrowed so quickly that I am in the last chamber already. And there in the corner stands the trap that I must run into. You only need to change your direction, said the cat, and ate it up. First, last newspaper to fold after 6 editions. Dexter Sinister commemorated the printing of their final first last newspaper and closing of their Port Authority office Saturday night, November the 21st, from 7 to 9 p.m. Visitors were able to collect remaining stock produced during the paper's brief 3-week existence, including the latest and last just delivered from Linco Printers in neighboring Long Island City. Also present in Port Authority space at the center, at the corner of 41st Street and 8th Avenue, was Gareth Spohr's version of Brian Gysin's seminal 1960s Dream Machine, a stenciled cylinder placed on a revolving turntable with a 100-watt lamp inside to produce a stroboscopic flicker that induces a supposed hypnagogic state when viewed with eyes closed. Spohr's update replaces Gysin's original pattern with open letter forms that spell out an aphorism by Gysin's friend and collaborator William Burroughs. Illusion is a revolutionary weapon. The public was advised that this machine may be dangerous for people with photosensitive epilepsy or other nervous disorders. Also available were portions of fish and chips wrapped in old issues of the first last newspaper. Due to concerns over ink poisoning, particularly related to old lead type, the tradition of wrapping fish and chips in newsprint has largely been phased out, despite industry workers' claims that modern newspaper inks, such as those used in Queens, pose no such health risks. Today's chip paper tomorrow's news, as the old Fleet Street saying goes. Surely this is, at last, the artless art. Sinister stressed that they would assume no responsibility for the public's epilepsy or poisoning. Thank you.